a question for you. Do you ever have anybody in a relationship just write you off? I admit that's kind of one of my character flaws, and I see it come out a little bit too often in my children. You know, sometimes as you get your as your children grow up, sometimes your worst flaws as a parent come out, and you see them exemplified without your filter. And so I've noticed that sometimes I have a tendency in relationships that if something happens, if it I don't like it, I can just write it off. And there's sometimes, you know, sometimes relationships need to move on. You know, they can be unhealthy, they can be toxic. You need to get those relationships out of your life. But sometimes, just because you're stubborn or pigheaded or whatever, you just write relationships off. When I was in college, I was on the receiving end of that. When I was a freshman, I went to Central Baptist College. It was a very small school in Conway, Arkansas. And within the first few weeks of being there, I met a friend, and his name was Russ. And Russ and I hit it off. Russ was several years older than me. He's like 8 years older than me. He was a non-traditional student. He'd kind of had a life and decided to come back to college later. But he was there, and when I moved in, he was an RA, and he and I just hit it off. We had common interests, and so we just started palling around together all the time. I mean, he was my let's get dinner on Saturday night, the Chinese food, and go watch Star Trek The Next Generation together friend. I am a Trekkie, and that was the friend that he was. I mean, he's the guy that went to the convention with me the time we did go to the Star Trek convention. I mean, that's a pretty close friend, right? I mean, that's a pretty significant friendship. And we were tight. We were thick as thieves for 3 years, or for 2 years, 2.5 years. But then after 2 years, Russ gets married, which wasn't a big deal. I loved his wife, and she was great, and we were still kind of hanging out. But my third year of school, my junior year, things got a little hectic for me. I was taking 19 hours of classes that spring semester. I was engaged to be married. I know, as a junior, what were you thinking? Exactly, 20 years old. working not just one part-time job, but two. I was working retail in a Christian bookstore Monday through Friday, and I had a church job on the weekend, so Brent was a little bit busy. I get that. But my friend Russ looked at my life, and it wasn't like there was any glaring, blatant sin going on. It wasn't like I was out drinking on the weekends and getting hammered every weekend or anything. It's just I was busy, but I always made time for things that were important, and like friends, they were important, and I'd always find time for friends. But for some reason, Russ decided that I didn't have time for him, and that I was too busy and I was making some mistakes in my life. And he thought it was his place to tell me about it, but also punish me for it. And so Russ decided to just exit from my life. No real explanation, no real anything. What's so sad about this story is that, as I said, I was engaged to be married, and Russ, because we had been friends for so many years, I'd already asked him to be my best man. But during that spring semester, it was very clear that he and I were on two different paths, and he had written me off. He had no interest in me. He was judgmental and critical of me. And I had to make that phone call where the last conversation I've ever had with him was, "You can't be my best man. We just aren't there in that place." I was on the receiving end of somebody who looked at me and said, "You don't have time for me. I don't approve of what you're doing. So I'm just going to cut you out of my life." I think sometimes, maybe you've experienced that too. But why I'm telling you that story is because I think many times we carry over a mentality like that into our relationship with God. And we assume that there is a point with God that we can do too much, we can say too much, we can sin so much that God just eventually looks at us and says, "That's it, I'm done with you. I'm out. You're on your own. Don't come crying to me." And we use that. We have experiences where we've been the recipient of human relationships like that. And so we make the assumption that because we treat one another that way, then surely it means that that's how God must deal and treat us. And that's the question I wanted to get to today. As we've looked at already, why might you walk away from God? We've kind of examined that a little bit a couple weeks ago. And last week, Ryan did a great job of talking to us about why God actually deserves a second chance, that maybe he's better than we think he is. Maybe he's faithful, more faithful than we think he is. Maybe the forgiveness he offers we really need. Maybe that purpose we're searching for is actually found in him. But today, even though God may deserve a second chance, and you may be in that place where you're saying, yes, I want to give God a second chance, but maybe you're to the place today where you're asking, would God give me a second chance? Would God give me a second chance? I mean, I get it. I understand how all this plays out. I understand that you may be in your life where things have happened to you, things that are not great. Life has just hit you. And you are angry with God. You're mad at God. You've cussed at God. And you think, oh, that's it. If you cuss at God, man, he's not big enough to handle that. So he's just like us. He gets his feelings hurt, and he's just going to smack us around a little bit because we did that. Is that the case? Is there ever a moment where we're too far gone from God? Or is it possible that regardless of where we are, regardless of what we've done, that God is a God who will give us another chance? And maybe you are sitting there, and maybe you're thinking, yeah, but I've already blown my second chance. I've already blown my third and fourth chances. Is it possible that God isn't just a God of a second chance, but of another chance? That's what I want us to look at today and kind of evaluate. Would God do that? Is this the case? Is there something different about God? Let's look. A couple weeks ago, when I spoke to you about why people walk away from God, we turned to Luke, the Gospel of Luke, where there's a very familiar parable that if you didn't grow up in church, you'd probably heard of it. The parable of the prodigal son. And when we looked at it a couple weeks ago, I looked at it kind of from a different angle because I wanted to look at it from the perspective of what may drive us away from God. And I just want to recap this story for you today because I think it's significant. I want to look at it from the perspective today of the Father. Look at it from the perspective of the Father to see how he responds, not just to one son, but two sons. One son who has walked away and decides to come home. Another son who is there trying to please the Father by doing everything right. How does God respond to these sons? And what can we take from that to learn how God will respond to us? The story's in Luke 15, and we're not going to read it today, but starting in verse 11, that's where we find it. And this is a parable. It's a story that Jesus told. So it's not a true story, but it's something that Jesus would use to bring the audience in, to teach a spiritual truth to them. And he did a lot of this speaking in parables. And what he would do is he would use parables to challenge the status quo. He would use a parable to really confront and challenge the way they were thinking. And this parable of the prodigal son would do just that. When the religious leaders are around him and they're questioning him and they don't like him, and when the sinners are there, the prostitutes and the tax collectors and people who are just normal like you and me, they're all sitting there. Jesus is telling this story to really say, maybe the spiritual realm is not like you think it is. Maybe God interacts with us differently than you think. And so he tells this story. There's a son who goes to his father, and the son says, Dad, I want my inheritance now. I want it right now. I can't wait for you to die. I wish you were dead already because my money, your money, my money is more important to me than you are. And so I want it now. Will you give it to me? And in a culture where the father should have beat the snot out of that son, kicked him out of his family, disinherited him, the whole thing, this father looks at his son and says, okay, I'll give you what you want. And he takes his estate and he gives him one third of the estate, which was what would happen with the younger son. The older son got two thirds. And then the son sets off to a foreign country to live it up. He's looked at how other people are living. He's seen the high life and he says, that's what I want. And this younger son does not disappoint. He does exactly everything you and I would expect him to do. He goes to that land, that foreign country, and he lives it up. He squanders every last penny that his father had given him to the point where he has nothing left. He has nothing, not a dime to his name. Well, not only is it his stupidity that puts him in this really difficult position. But then a famine hits the land, and not just he's doing bad, everybody's doing bad. The economy's terrible, there are no jobs, there's no food, there's no anything. And so he's left in this foreign country struggling and no one to help him. He finally does find a job, and he's feeding the pigs, which for a Jewish, young Jewish guy would have been a horrible job, the lowest of the lowest jobs that you could possibly imagine. And as he's doing this job, he's so hungry that he's even willing to eat the pig slop. But the owner of the pigs wouldn't even let him do that. He's literally dying. He's dying. And we read that one day, though, he comes to his senses. And what could be translated also, he repented, is another way to look at that. He thought to himself, even my dad's servants have it better than I do. So you know what? I'm just going to go home. I'm going to tell my dad, Dad, I'm a screw up. I have blown it big time. And I'm going to beg him, Dad, please just let me be one of your slaves. I don't want to be one of your servants that gets to live here on the property, that gets to eat and everything. I'll be the lowest of the low. I'll be a day laborer. I'll show up at the house every day, hat in hand, to say, sir, do you have any work for me today? That's what I'm going to do. And he has this speech all worked out in his head, and he says, all right, that's what I'm going to do. And I'm going to tell him, I'm going to say, Dad, I've sinned against heaven and against you. I'm not worthy to be your son. Make me a servant. That's what I'm going to do. And with this plan in mind, he's got everything worked out, and he sets off and goes home. But when he is still a long way off, his dad sees him coming, overwhelmed with compassion. The father takes off running as fast as he can. And when he reaches the son, he throws his arms around his neck. And literally translated in the scripture, he falls on his neck. He's so excited to see his son. In this incredible embrace, he takes his son and he kisses him. The son, quite literally surprised by this moment, begins that speech he had rehearsed. Dad, I've sinned against heaven and against you. I am no longer worthy to be called your son. Dad, unable to finish the rest of his rehearsed speech, the father interrupts him and looks to his servant and he says, hey, hurry, quick, do this fast. Bring out the best robe and put it on him. Bring out the family ring, the signet ring, the important ring. Bring that out and put it on his finger. And he's barefooted. Bring out some shoes. Put some shoes on his feet. And let's have a party. My son was dead and is alive again. He was lost, but now is found. The story goes on. It doesn't just end there, because we go on and we get the second son, who'd been working in the field, who'd stayed with the father. He comes up and he hears all the commotion in the party, and the son's like, what's going on? Servant says, hey, your brother's back. Anybody here have sibling rivalry in your family? This is the key case of sibling rivalry. What do you mean my brother's back? My loser of a brother? That brother who stole half the third of my dad's money, went off and squandered it on whores and liquor, and just wasted and frittered it away? He's a punk. What's the party for? And the servant says, it's because your dad said he was dead. Now he's alive. He was lost and he's found. Well, the older son is just ticked. And he's like, I'm not going in there. So in another amazing act of compassion, the father leaves the party and comes out to meet the older son. He says, son, why don't you come in with us? Come and enjoy. Come and celebrate in this party with us. And the older son won't hear it. He won't have it. He said, Dad, I've been here my whole life with you. I've been slaving away for you, and you have never once thrown me a party. You killed the best cow for him, and you won't even give me and my friends a goat. And this guy, this son of yours, he's not my brother. He's your son. He wasted everything. And look at what you're doing for him. And the father looks at this son, and he says, my son, you are always with me. And everything I have is yours. But we had to celebrate. Your brother was dead and is now alive. He was lost, but now is found. And with that, Jesus ends the story. When you read this, there is so much in this story. It's an amazing story that Jesus tells. And it begins with what I see as two different attitudes from two different sons. And I think as we talk about them, maybe in one of these two sons, you'll find yourself. I know I did when I was reading through it this week. You see, the first son, the younger son, is the son that comes back to the father, and he twice says to him, I am not worthy. I am not worthy. He looks to the father. He knows what he's done. He sees his pitiful, wretched condition, and he says, I'm not worthy, God, to be called your son. And you know what? He's right. Everything he'd done deserved disinheriting by the family. Every action he had taken meant that family should have just said, you are dead to us. We have moved on. He says, I'm not worthy, and he is right. He is not worthy. Just by making the request for his inheritance was an insult to the father. This is a culture of shame and honor. And the shame that would have been brought on this family by the son even making this request was incredible. The father didn't just lose some money over this. He lost position in the community. He began to be looked down upon because everybody else went, oh, look at that family. Look at that dad. Was this guy worthy? Absolutely not. But there was a double shame in the fact that he didn't go off and invest it and make millions off of it. He went and squandered it. He wasted everything. A double shaming on this family. And you know what? He's not worthy. But what the younger son shows us is something so significant, is that our worth, our value is not determined by who you are or what you've done. It is determined by the Father and who He says you are and who you are in Him. Our value, our worth is never dependent upon how many good deeds you can check off on a list, how many minutes you read your Bible today. It's never about that. Your worth, your value is always what God says about you, period. It's determined by the Father. The son wasn't worthy. He would have been lucky, lucky to be a slave of the dad. But the Father looks at him and says, you are my son. And then he does three things that if we're not careful in that story, we'll just gloss right over. And when I first read it and was studying this, I thought, why have I never seen this before? Because the father does three things to the son to signify his position with the father. He first, and we're doing them out of order because I like it this way, but he says, bring this guy some shoes, put some sandals on his feet. You know who went barefooted? Slaves. You know who had no shoes? Slaves. The lowest of the low in that culture and society. They are the ones who had no shoes, no sandals. And when the father says, put some shoes on his feet, he says, you are not a slave. You are a son. You are free as a member of this family. You're not going to be a slave. Put shoes on him so he knows who he is. He then says, get a robe. Put a robe on him. And that robe was a symbol of position. You didn't put a robe on anybody. You put a robe on family. This was conferring upon him, yeah, you don't deserve to be my son. I'm telling you, it doesn't matter. I'm calling you my son. And then the third thing is he says, puts that ring on his finger. This ring that in this culture that was everything. This was your signature. This was what you put on paperwork to sign contract, to put your word against things. And the father is saying to the son, I'm giving you not just position. I'm not just making you free. I'm giving you authority. You now can speak again for the family. You're not a less than son. You're not a half son. You're a full son, welcomed completely and totally back into this family. Three things that symbolize the position that the son was restored to. And think about the great risk that the father was taking by doing this. Would we do that for this son? No, I'm sorry, you've screwed up. I'm not giving you the checkbook to my bank account. or the debit card or the credit card. Stupid child. You've blown it. I mean, amen, right? I mean, let's just be real here. I mean, humanly speaking, none of us would have done what the Father did. In fact, some of us would look at this and go, that's a little reckless. That's a little bit reckless for the Father to do. Because what if the Son looks at the Father again and says, I'm out of here? But you know what? Doesn't seem to faze the Father at all. The Father still gives him the shoes, gives him the robe, and gives him the ring. Amazing. Amazing. There's another condition I think we see in the story, though. The first son says, I'm not worthy, and he's correct. But the second son has, an even more damaging position. Because whereas the younger son says, I'm not worthy, the older brother believes, I am worthy. And I'm worthy because of everything I've done. I'm worthy because of all the work I've done for you. I've been the good son. I've stayed home to work. And therefore, because I've done everything that you've expected, you owe me, God. You owe me, Father. You owe me. But what is so sad about the older son is that because he was so busy trying to earn his worth that he missed what was right in front of him. He missed it. As a son, he did not have to earn it. Everything the Father had was his. Did you catch that? Everything, the Father says that to him, everything I've had has always been yours. But the older son was so busy trying to earn it, he missed it. He failed to see who he truly was because he was too busy trying to earn something that couldn't be earned to begin with. Now, I don't know about you, but as I listen to those two options there, personally, I find myself in the second camp. I find myself in the category of the older son who tried to earn God's approval, the Father's approval. Maybe some of you are in that category. Maybe you're on the flip side. Maybe you think about your life, you think about the number of screw-ups that you've had and how you've failed many times. And you sit here today and you say, I'm not worthy. Let's dig a little deeper into the Father's response. How does the Father respond? His response is really the most significant part of the story. And we can't miss this. Because first what we notice is that the Father is looking. The Father is looking. And he is waiting. And he is hoping for the son's return. You don't find the Father in the field working. You don't find him in the house mowing around. In this story, where is the Father? He's sitting on the front porch. And he's looking down the long driveway. And why? He's looking with expectant eyes, thinking, oh God, I hope my son comes home. I hope my son comes home. The Father is actively seeking him. And think about what a shock this would have been to the original audience hearing, excuse me, a little bit in my throat here, the audience hearing this story. Yep, the rabbis of that day believed that God would welcome the repentant sinner, that he would have been undignified, seen below his position, to be looking for somebody, to pursuing the repentant sinner. That would have been outrageous. They had this vision of God, where God is here, and if you want to come to God, you come on your hands and knees and you come crawling back, you worthless worm. And Jesus says, let me challenge that thinking a little bit. He says, it's not the Son crawling back. It's even when the Son is just a speck on the horizon. Even when I may not even be completely sure it's the Son that walked away, the Father gets up and pursues him. And when he sees the Son, his response is equally, if not even more, outrageous. Think about it. Parents, you've given your kids $10,000. They've gone and blown it on craziness, gambling, liquor, whatever, and they come back home. How many of us are running down that road and going, oh my gosh, you're home? Maybe my wife, but that's her. Brent, on the other hand, would not. I would let them crawl back. And then you know what I would do. I would look at them and I'd say, hope you learned your lesson. It was painful, wasn't it? Hurt a little bit? Good. Glad it did. So maybe you won't be so stupid again. I wouldn't be this hard. This is hyperbole for effect, okay? My kids are back there. My kids are honestly back there going, no, I've heard you say this before, Dad. My kids will be unavailable to speak to after the service today. But most of us would not run to the child, right? We'd want to say, hey, have you learned your lesson yet? Have you learned what you needed to learn because you've been foolish and you've squandered everything? I think that's where most of us would end up. If we saw the kid pulling up after being away, especially after they squandered everything, we might be thinking this too. Great, they're back for more money. But it's amazing to me how that never crosses the father's mind. Even with the shame and disgrace that was brought on this family, we might have expected the father to make his son make that long walk of shame to where he was and drop to his knees and beg for forgiveness, but not this dad. He does something that every single commentary I read said was completely disgraceful. It was demeaning for him to do. What did he do? He lifted up his robe and his tunic, showed his legs. Not common for the patriarch to do. That's what women did. That's what children did. That's what the less thans did, not the fathers. He lifted his robe and tunic, baring his legs, and he ran as quickly as he could. In this time, it was not common for the superior to go to the inferior. It's just the opposite. But this dad, he runs. He runs. He undignifies himself as fast as he can. And before his son can even get the words out of his mouth, he interrupts him. He won't let this son grovel. He won't debase his son. He won't let his son even pay him back this enormous debt. Instead, before the son can even get everything out of his mouth, the father shows this son incredible acceptance. And he says, welcome home, my child. I've got this. And what we see in the father is the son goes from destitution to restoration. Like that. I struggle with this a bit. Seems a little extravagant, wasteful. I mean, where's the I told you so? Where's the finger wagging in his face, teaching him a lesson? It's not there. There's no rebuke. There's a party. What's going on? What we see here is the extravagant love of God, a love that isn't limited to the nice story that Jesus told 2,000 years ago. It's a love that is available to us today. The Apostle Paul wrote in Ephesians chapter 3, listen to this. He says, and may you have the power to understand, as all God's people should, how wide, how long, how high, how deep his love is. May you experience the love of Christ, though it is too great to fully understand. It is too great to fully understand. And when we see the reckless and extravagant and amazing grace and amazing love of the Father, it is hard to comprehend. It exceeds any love that we have ever experienced here on earth. Because a lot of times the love and acceptance and forgiveness that we're used to is this kind. You married? You leave your dirty underwear on the floor? Maybe I'm the only one. And your wife forgives you and says, that's all right, I'll try to do better. That's not the kind of love or forgiveness that we're talking about, a wife or a spouse or somebody that overlooks this minor, insignificant thing in your life. You know the kind of love that's demonstrated here? It's the spouse that says, I wish you were dead. I'm leaving you, goes out and cheats on you and comes back. And you say, welcome home. I don't know, any of you experienced that kind of love before? That's the kind of love that God is demonstrating to us. That's what we're dealing with. a father who is looking, who is not going to drag you kicking and screaming back. He doesn't want you if you don't want him. He wants you to want to come back. He wants you to want him, and he's not going to go drag you kicking and screaming. He wants you to come home. He longs to embrace you, and he waits, offering you forgiveness, no grudges, and all the past pain to be washed away. And the question is, will you take that first step back? That's where it begins. Are you willing to get up out of the slop and turn back towards God? And we want to make this complicated. We want to make it difficult. We say, what do I do? What did the son do? He picked himself up. He turned around, and there was the father. One step is all it took, and the father was right there, already there. One of the things I haven't shared with you is why this story is so significant to me. Because this story of the prodigal son was instrumental in my faith journey. I was a sophomore in high school. Have a picture there for you. Yep. Heard somebody say Jaden. Yep. I actually had to text my mother and say, hey, can you send me a picture? I know they'll love this. So there's Brent at his sophomore year of high school. Yes, the glasses are cool. Thank you. My sophomore year of high school, my dad decided it was time to change churches. So one Sunday morning, unbeknownst to me or my mother or any of my siblings, at the end of a Sunday morning service, my dad gets done preaching and he reads a resignation letter, and we're all just sitting there kind of like, oh, what just happened here? Yeah, even my mother didn't know. Yeah. And so a few weeks later, he was done, and this church was in Texarkana. It didn't take him long to find another job. He found a church in Little Rock, 2 hours away. And so I knew what that meant. We were going to have to be picking up and leaving and moving away, which would be me starting a new high school right before my junior year. People I'd grown up with, I wouldn't be graduating high school with. And for a 16-year-old, this is a pretty, you know, tumultuous time, a little difficult. Soon after my dad accepted that new job in Little Rock, we were finishing out the school year. We had just a few months left. But on weekends, we'd usually go up to Little Rock to see my dad. Occasionally, my crazy parents would leave me home alone, 16-year-old by myself. I had transportation. I had a lovely 1971 Datsun pickup to get me around. That was amazing. But one weekend, I remember they left me home, and I had a major crisis of faith. I don't know how to describe it, except it was just one of the most memorable, terrifying, outrageous weekends of my life. I wasn't in the middle of any great sin. I was just home alone doing my own thing, nothing major. But there was something about this weekend that God got my attention. And I realized for the first time in my life that my relationship with God was not what I thought it was. I'd grown up in church. I was a good kid. I was a leader in the youth group, did anything, sang in the church, sang special music from the time I was 4 years old. I mean, it's just like, you know, I'd done it all. But this evening, this Saturday evening, I knew something was off in my relationship with God, and it terrified me. Looking back now, I see where I was the older brother. I was doing and saying all the right things, but I was doing it all for the wrong reasons. I was doing it to earn God's approval so that he would accept me as good. But God got my attention. I was freaked out. I mean, I'm panicking. I'm like, oh my gosh, what's going on spiritually here? I mean, I'm crying and just overwhelmed emotionally, and I'm like, oh, something's happening. Called my parents, they're not home, couldn't get them, I'm freaking out, you know. So finally I called my youth pastor, drove to the church where he met me, and we met for a few hours, and he said a few things and tried to help comfort me and all this. Went back home that Saturday night, by the grace of God, was able to sleep. Woke up that next morning, went to church, heard a hellfire and brimstone sermon, which was highly appropriate, I guess. Left church, still just in this tension, just knowing something wasn't right with me and God. But I'd grown up in church. I'd done all the right things. And sometimes that barrier is even harder to get over than any other barrier. I was sitting at home that Sunday afternoon. I was playing on my computer, yes, in 1990. I had a Commodore 64 computer that I loved to play. I've been a techno nerd my whole life. But as I'm sitting there playing games on my computer, trying to distract myself from the turmoil inside. In my little boombox next to my computer, I was listening to a cassette tape. If you don't know what those are, ask your parents, they'll tell you. The school that the college I ended up going to would put out a tape every year, a recording of their choir and their ensemble. And they'd come to our church and I'd bought it. And so I loved to listen to it. It was my dream to be in that choir and sing in that ensemble, which I was fortunate enough to do years later. But as I'm sitting there listening to this song play, one song came on and I'd listened to it many, many times and it just caught my attention this time. The song was based on the story of the prodigal son. And I don't know what made this time different than any other, but as I listened to it this time, the chorus really stuck out. I couldn't tell you any of the lyrics. I can only tell you a phrase of the chorus at the end. As I sat there listening and as I thought about my own spiritual condition, the song had these words, "Oh, my Father, I want to come back into your arms." I rewound it a few times, which is much more difficult than hitting the back 10-second button on your iPhone. And I listened to it over and over again. And finally, just in a moment of desperation, had those words come out of my mouth as a prayer. And I just said, "Oh God, oh my Father, I want to come back into your arms." And in that moment, I didn't find a finger-wagging God. I've been trying to get you. I've been trying to tell you. I didn't get a list of here's 10 things you need to do to clean yourself up, Brent. What I found was the welcome and warm embrace of a father. And in that moment, I wish I could describe it any other way, but it was just a switch flipped in my life. The terror, the fear, the apprehension, the turmoil, the stress in that moment was gone. And my whole soul was flooded with just incredible joy. I can even remember, you know how sometimes things are just stick out in your memory? I remember getting up from my computer and going and looking in the mirror. In my mind, I see my bedroom as it was laid out as a 16-year-old. I get up and I walk over here to my mirror and I look and all I can do is smile. This stupid grin will not leave my face because I know for the first time I have encountered God. And my life was His. Maybe today, in the story of the prodigal, you find yourself. Maybe today, it's the younger son or the older son, or maybe it's somewhere in between. But maybe today, it's time to look and say, "Oh, my Father, I want to come back." And for you, for the first time, to experience the amazing love of a father that pours out on you this incredible acceptance and forgiveness and love that you have never been able to experience before. That's what this story is about. This story is very incredible to me just because of this. Jesus told this story not so we could look and say, "Which son are you necessarily?" even though it's easy for us to do. He told this story because He wanted to reveal to us the heart of the Father. To show you that there is a God who will pursue you and will never stop looking for you. What's interesting about this is this story is open-ended. Did the older son go to the party? Don't know. What happened? Did the younger son stay and live happily ever after? We don't know. It doesn't end that way. It's an open-ended story, just like it's an open-ended invitation that God extends to you today. The question we are posing today is, would God give you a second chance? And the resounding answer is yes. God died to give you a second chance. When Jesus Christ came to this earth, when He lived His life, when He went to the cross, it was God dying to give you a second chance. There's nothing for you to pay for in your sin. Your shame, it's already been covered by Jesus Christ. Don't let what led you away from God keep you from God. Maybe like the younger son, you thought life was better elsewhere. Maybe the circumstances of your life just sucked. Maybe the church has hurt you. Whatever it is that convinced you God wasn't worth it, don't let that keep you away. There is a Father who is passionately pursuing you. God is looking for you. The question is, do you want to be found? Do you want to be found? And as you turn and you take just that first step towards the Father, I think I know that you will be amazed to see that the Father has already run to you. He will interrupt you. He will put the ring and the robe and the shoes on you. And he will say to you, "Welcome home, not my servant, but welcome home, my child." Would you pray with me? I've preached long, big shock. But as we close today, I just want to ask you this question. Where are you with God? Are you unwilling to get out of the slop, to get away from the things that have led you from God? Your pride may be keeping you away. Or maybe you just look and you say, "But I'm good enough. I've done enough. I'm smart enough. I'm strong enough. God owes me." Or maybe you're somewhere in between. But today, as you've heard the story of the prodigal son, you look and you realize that you want to feel, you need to feel the embrace of a father who, when he comes to you, he throws himself at you and wraps his arms so tightly around your neck you can hardly breathe, and he kisses you all over your face. And as you begin to talk, he says, "Shut up. There's nothing for you to say. I thought you were dead. You're alive. You were lost. Now you're found." Maybe you need to experience that this morning. We're not going to sing long, but we're going to just sing one verse of a song. And if that's you, if you are desperately needing and crying out for the embrace of the Father, I'm going to be standing down here in the front. I'm going to just say, "Come grab me." And let's pray together. And let's take that first step together back home into the arms of our Father.